We'll pick up the story now of David and his time of persecution and flight from Saul at the point that we left off last time. And that was, that means we need to begin at, I think we're at chapter 25. Yes. Chapter 25 is where we'll begin. And verse 1 is a standalone verse. Could have been stuck in anywhere along here, but it's time to introduce this fact, and that is the death of Samuel. Now, David has been fleeing. We don't know for how long, because this particular section of 1 Samuel is, it's a little frustrating to me, only because it doesn't tell us the time gaps between events. David's time fleeing from Saul could have been years long or months long, or conceivably even only weeks long. Now, probably, I think months long at least is implied just by the number of things that happen and the distance he has to cover. But I think it's probably more than a year, and it could have been some years that he fled from Saul. But a number of things occurred of significance, and of course the majority of the things that happened must be left unrecorded. I would say, though, that in the end of chapter 24, when it says David swore to Saul that he would not destroy Saul's father's house when he became king. You remember in chapter 24, David spared Saul's life in the cave. Saul had a momentary flash of decency and said, "Oh, you know, you're better than I am. You should be the king. God's on your side, so forth. Swear to me that when you're king, you won't wipe out my family line." David swore to Saul, and Saul went home. And you might think that David would then go home too. He, after all, he has a wife at home somewhere in Jerusalem, not in Jerusalem, but wherever they were living in those days, Gibeah, I think. And yet he doesn't go home. It says David and his men went up to the stronghold. They knew Saul well enough by now to know that he might swear by the Lord that he's not going to persecute David and hurl a spear at him the next day to try to pin him to the wall. So they're not safe until Saul's dead, and yet they obviously are not going to take the matter into their own hands, although his men were inclined to do so. David would not let them kill Saul, as he put it. In verse 12 of chapter 24, he said, "Let the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you." David was not opposed to God killing Saul. He was probably looking forward to the day that Saul would be gone out of his life as a torment, but he was not going to do this himself. He was going to leave it to God. Now, after this encounter with Saul, David remained in the stronghold, which was a natural stronghold. It's not talking about a man-made fortress or anything like that, but rather to a mountainous region, very inaccessible and therefore a good place to hide. But in the book of 1 Chronicles, chapter 12, we read that while David was there, the ranks of his loyal followers swelled a bit with some significant warriors joining him. And it's not hard to understand why they would. Here we have a case where Saul's out with 3,000 soldiers pursuing David. And this, right before their eyes, David comes out waving us of Saul's robe in front of everybody and says, "Listen, I was this close to Saul. I could have killed him. I obviously didn't." And everyone even hears Saul shout out to David, "You are going to be the king. I am, you know, I'm evil and you're good." And I mean, in these moments of sanity, Saul recognizes the truth and even admits it. Now, what would your mindset be if you're one of the 3,000 soldiers there with Saul pursuing David and you see all this happen? Obviously, you'd say, "I'm really following the wrong guy here, you know." Now, following Saul was safer in natural terms because no one was chasing Saul or his men. Following David was more dangerous, but it was quite obviously the right thing to do. David was obviously the right man. And at this point in time, at the end of chapter 24, David, while in the stronghold, was joined by some warriors from Saul's side who defected to him. In 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verses 8 through 18, we read that some mighty men of the tribe of Gad and also some Benjamites joined David while he was there at the stronghold. This is in 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verses 8 through 18. It says, "Some Gadites joined David at the stronghold in the wilderness, mighty men of valor, men trained for battle, who could handle shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions and were as swift as gazelles on the mountains." This is hyperbole, but obviously they were exceptional specimens. And it gives the names of quite a few of them there. And then in verse 16, It says, then some of the children of Benjamin and Judah came to David at the stronghold. And David went out to meet them and answered and said to them, if you've come peaceably to me to help me, my heart will be united with you. But if to betray me to my enemies, since there is no wrong in my hands, may God of our fathers look and bring judgment. Now, realize that if men were defecting from Saul to David, David would not know for sure what their intentions were. It might be that they were noble men who recognized the virtue of David and wanted to side with him. It might be that it was a plot. I mean, these men had only recently been loyal to Saul pursuing David. How was he to know whether they were now going to join him only for the purpose of betraying him? They could. And so all he does is invoke God. He doesn't know. So he says, well, if you're here to do wrong to me, then the God of our fathers look and bring judgment. David realized he was in no position to know their hearts or their minds, and he just committed it to God to defend him in that matter and judge those that were who might have a plot against him. Then the Spirit, verse 18, 1 Chronicles 12:18, then the Spirit came upon Amasai, chief of the captains, this would be of the men of Benjamin who were joining him, and he said, we are yours, O David, we are on your side, O son of Jesse. Peace, peace to you, and peace to your helpers, for your God helps you. So David received them and made them captains of the troops. So prior to this, we had read that David had 600 men. In fact, that was considerably earlier. His numbers might have grown considerably since the last notice of the number of men with him. But significant chiefs of Saul's army, of Gadites and Benjamites, now at this point defected to David. And we'll find that that's not the last time this happened. Later on, when he's in another location, some more of Saul's men defect to him. So that Saul's losing some of his best men, and David is gaining them. Now, chapter 25 of 1 Samuel, verse 1 says, then Samuel died, and the Israelites gathered together and lamented for him and buried him at his home in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. Now, Samuel's been out of the story for a while already. And obviously, since he dies here, he's never reappeared in his earthly form. The mention of his death may simply be out of respect, even though he's no longer a player in the story. He was certainly a significant figure in the earlier narrative. And it may be that mention of his death is given so that it'll make sense of a later story, near a few chapters from now, when Saul wants to consult Samuel, but of course Samuel's not available, and so Saul goes and talks to a medium, a witch who is able to conjure up Samuel's spirit. If we had not known of Samuel's death, we would... it would take us by surprise that Saul needed to conjure him up. And so this may be simply mentioned, as I say, to close down the name of an honorable man, but also to play the role of anticipating a time when Saul will no longer be able to consult Samuel and will want to, and will seek to conjure him up from the grave. Now, from verse 2 on, through the rest of this chapter, actually, at least until the very closing verses of the chapter, we have an extended story, a long one, about a man named Nabal, we would probably anglicize his name to be pronounced, and his wife Abigail. It's a story that carries itself along quite nicely. I could make comments all the way through, but because of the shortness of our time, I will read the story, and then I'll make comments in retrospect, having reached the end of it. So it starts at verse 2. Now, there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats, and he was shearing his sheep in Carmel. And the name of the man was Nabal, which happens to mean fool. And the name of his wife, Abigail. And she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful appearance. Why does it mention that? Probably because it anticipates David's interest in her later. But the man was harsh and evil in his doings. Obviously a mismatch. And he was of the house of Caleb. When David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep, David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name. And thus you shall say to him who lives in prosperity, peace be to you, peace to your house, and peace to all that you have. Now I have heard that you have shearers. Your shepherds were with us, and we did not hurt them, nor was anything missing from them all the while they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give us whatever comes to your hand and to your servants and to your son David. So when David's young men came, spoke to Nabal according to all these words, in the name of David and waited. I'm going to break my promise and make a brief comment. And that is that David points out that not only is he not taken forcibly from people's servants food, which David was certainly in the position to do with all these warriors on his side, living out there in the wilderness, being hungry and all, they might be tempted to forcibly steal a few sheep from a wealthy man who could hardly miss them. David points out, not only have we not taken them, but we've protected them. No one has taken them. No thieves, no cattle thieves have ever been permitted. We've been like protectors of your flock, and your servants can bear witness to this. Therefore, if you wouldn't mind showing a bit of gratitude, it is a feast day, and we'd like to have something to eat too. So whatever you feel inclined to give, my servants would be glad to bring back to us. Verse 10, then Nabal answered David's servants and said, who is David? And who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants nowadays who break away, each one from his master. Shall I then take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men whom, when I do not know where they are from? Now, of course, Nabal knew who David was. David knew who he was, and David was more famous than him. David was a nationally known figure. But Nabal was either afraid of incurring the wrath of Saul. You know, he just acted like, I don't care. David, this is none of my business. There's a lot of servants break away from their masters, implying that David was like a runaway slave running from Saul. And he didn't want to side with him. He just acted like, I don't know anything about you or any obligations I have to you. Beat it. Get away from my door. So David's young men turned on their heels and went back, and they came and told him all these words. Then David said to his men, every man gird on his sword. Now this is unlike David for the most part. In most of the places we've read, David will consult the Lord. He'll call a priest and consult the Urim and the Thummim to see whether he should fight. David is acting rashly and in the flesh here. He's not doing the right thing. He insulted the Lord. He's just angry because he was hungry and very insulted by this man's response. So every man girded his sword, and David also girded on his sword, and about 400 men went with David, and 200 stayed with the supplies. Now one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, saying, look, David sent messengers from the wilderness to greet our master, and he reviled them. So even the servants were offended by their master's conduct and thought to appeal to his wife for some sanity. But the men were very good to us, and we were not hurt, nor did we miss anything as long as we accompanied them, the servants were telling Abigail, when we were in the fields. They were like a wall to us both by night and day, all the time we were with them, keep sheep. That is, like a wall to us means a defense. These men, they prevented anyone from attacking us. Now, therefore, know and consider what you will do. For harm is determined against our master and against all his household, for he is such a scoundrel that one cannot speak to him. Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed. I don't know why the sheep had to get dressed, but anyway, dressed means prepared for cooking. 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, and 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. And she said to her servants, go on before me. See, I am coming after you. But she did not tell her husband Nabal. So it was, as she rode on the donkey, that she went down under cover of the hill. And there were David and his men coming down toward her, and she met them. Now David had said, sure in vain I have protected all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him. And he has repaid me evil for good. May God do so and more to me, and more also to the enemies of David, if I leave one male of all who belong to him by morning light. Now, it's a good thing David worded his oath that way, because as it turned out, he did change his mind and didn't kill any of the males of Nabal. He swore, God do so and more to the enemies of David, if a male that breathes alive. If he had said, may God do so to me and more, as would be the normal way of swearing the oath, then he would be incurring his own death sentence by his own change of his mind after making the oath. What he actually wished was not on himself, but on his enemies. Give him motivation to break his oath, as a matter of fact, because what he's saying is, if I don't keep this oath, may my enemies, you know, come to a terrible end. Well, it seems like the oath would carry more weight if he said, may I come to a terrible end if I don't fulfill my oath. But it's actually fortunate that he stated it this way, or else he would have been unable to change his mind without bringing judgment on himself. As it turned out, he did change his mind and brought judgment on his enemies. Verse 23, now when Abigail saw David, she hastened to dismount from the donkey, fell on her face before David, and bowed down to the ground. So she fell at his feet and said, on me, my lord, on me let this iniquity be. And please let your maidservant speak in your ears and hear the words of your maidservant. Now, when she says, let this iniquity be on me, she means, if you're going to hurt anyone, let it be on me. Now, of course, she had no wrong. But this is occasionally the way that people in Scripture talk about blame. It can be transferred. Someone can take it for another person. An innocent party can say, oh, punish me. Paul does that in the book of Philemon. He says to Philemon, if your runaway slave Onesimus has wronged you or robbed you of anything, put that on my account. Treat it as if it's my debt. Saul assumes the guilt for the runaway slave and basically says to Philemon, if you want to punish him, punish me. If you want to charge anyone for that, charge me. Judah said something like that when he was trying to persuade Jacob to let him take Benjamin into Egypt because they couldn't get grain if Benjamin didn't go. Remember, Judah said, let it fall on me. I'll take responsibility. And when, in fact, Benjamin was in danger of being kept in Egypt, Judah said, I take responsibility. Let his offense be on me. I'll take it. That's what Abigail's doing. She's basically saying, my husband has done a rotten thing. He's a scoundrel. But may the guilt of it be on me. Meaning, if you want to hurt somebody, hurt me. Now, of course, this is a very conniving thing to do, in a sense. I mean, I'm not saying she was bad, but how could David possibly, seeing this gracious and beautiful woman before him, say, yeah, let's kill her, when she had not done anything to insult him. And yet, he could hardly now execute judgment on her husband since she had assumed the guilt. I mean, she had basically said, I'm taking on the guilt of this situation. If you want to hurt someone, hurt me. And yet, David, as we later find, was quite smitten with her. And so he was, obviously, she was not in any real danger of him deciding to execute her in her husband's place. She was a wise woman, and actually David states so a little later here. Anyway, she says in verse 25, please, let not my Lord regard the scoundrel Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly or foolishness is with him, because Nabal means fool. But I, your maidservant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has held you back from coming to bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hand, now let your enemy and those who seek your harm for my Lord be as Nabal. And now this present which your maidservant has brought to my Lord, let it be to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive and the trespass of your servant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house because my Lord fights the battles of the Lord. And evil is not found in you throughout your days. It's quite clear the household of Nabal was not ignorant of David. She knew all about him, and so did Nabal. So his professed ignorance was phony. Yet a man has risen to pursue you and seek your life, meaning Saul. But the life of my Lord, it shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he will sling out as from a pocket of a sling. Alluding, no doubt, to one of David's most famous exploits earlier in his life. That as David has slung a stone against one of his enemies, so God will sling his enemies out of the country or out of the land of the living. But David's life will be preserved and bound up in the bundle of the living. Not excluded from the category of those who are living, whereas his enemies will be slung from the bundle of the living. And it shall come to pass when the Lord has done for my Lord, according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you ruler over Israel, that this will be no grief to you, nor offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause, or that my Lord has avenged himself. But when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your maidservant. Now, her argument is essentially that, Nabal and his offense against you is not so great and so important as to give you something to sully your reputation that you've maintained up to this point of not avenging yourself. He definitely shown he would not avenge himself against Saul. And she says, you're just kind of you're kind of doing this ill-advisedly. If you go out and do what you want to do, you'll regret it later after God has elevated you. You'll wish that you'd come clean all the way up and you'll have something to regret about this. Why don't you think twice about this, she's saying. And she admits that her husband's a scoundrel and that what he did was foolish. But she's basically appealing to David's trust in the Lord. That, what can a man like Nabal do to prevent David from experiencing exaltation as God has promised him? And if David just goes out and does this angry deed, it will be an occasion for David to have a smitten conscience later on about it. And she's quite right, I'm sure. By the way, earlier when I talked about her taking the iniquity on herself, I missed a classic opportunity for a preacher to make an application to Christ, obviously. the idea in the Old Testament or in the New that one person can take the guilt of another, and that that preserves the guilty party from actually suffering for his deeds, because an innocent party said, "That guilt be upon me," is an obvious type, a picture of how the atonement has worked for us, how Jesus has assumed our guilt, how all we, like sheep, have gone astray, but the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all, it says in Isaiah 53:6. And there are similar passages in the New Testament. Anyway, shouldn't go too far beyond that point without making that statement. Verse 32, "Then David said to Abigail, 'Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed is your advice, and blessed are you, because you have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and from avenging myself with my own hand. For indeed, as the Lord lives, he, who has kept me from hurting you, unless you had hastened and come to meet me, surely by morning light, no males would have been left to Nabal.'" And that would have included Abigail's own sons, if she had any. So she saved her children's lives, as well as her husband's and the servants'. "So David received from her hand what she brought him, and said to her, 'Go up in peace to your house. See, I have heeded your voice and respected your person.'" Now, a question arises, but I'm not sure if it can be answered. And that is, was it right for Abigail to go behind her husband's back, to go against his wishes, to do what he stated an unwillingness to do? He was not willing to help David, but she did disobey her husband. I mean, he had not specifically told her not to do this, but she knew exactly what her husband's wishes were and defied them. Went behind his back. And under ordinary circumstances, we would say this is not really the conduct of a wife who is to be submitted to her husband as the church is to Christ. And yet the thing that muddies the waters in this ethical picture is that she saved her husband's life and her children's life and her servant's life. And her husband obviously made a very stupid choice. And the question then becomes, you know, does the end justify the means? Should she have done this? The Bible nowhere says that she did the right thing or the wrong thing. It doesn't. I mean, David said she did a wise thing, and he was glad she did. The Bible doesn't tell us whether she acted as a wife ought to act. I'm inclined to judge in her favor, frankly, and I think most of us are. I think the Bible generally stands with her. I mean, she is presented as she's never stated to be virtuous. But it was certainly the results of what she did were good. She had a clearer head. She had more moral sense than her husband did. And in this case, perhaps because he had never directly forbidden her to do this, she had, in a sense, the right to do it. She did tell him about it the next day, I think. And so we have, it's not like she's been altogether secretive. This is, I would say, an extenuating circumstance. And it may be that despite the general command that women should submit to their husbands as the church does to Christ, there may be extenuating circumstances where the husband is so out of touch with moral right and wrong that the wife simply can't stand by him and should, in a sense, resist his actions. Even think all who take a strong stand on woman's submission to her husband, and I'm one of those, generally will say that it's not right for a woman to submit to her husband when he's doing something morally wrong or when he's requiring something morally wrong to be done by her. And I think perhaps we should assume that what Nabal was doing was morally evil. He was not showing gratitude to David. He was siding with David's enemies, or at least refusing to take a side with what was right. It was morally wrong. His wife knew it was morally wrong. And in a sense, since she had the authority as a mistress of the household to give away some of the household goods, if he had forbidden her outright from doing it, he would be telling her to do something wrong, something sinful. And of course, he didn't forbid outright. So I suppose that this is a case where a woman would be justified, although the Bible doesn't say she did right or wrong. The implication is it's a good thing she did it. And I think this is a case where we'd find the Bible justifies a woman disobeying or going against what her husband wishes because he is morally, out of touch, and for her to go along with him would be immoral and hurtful for the family. The problem with acknowledging this is not that, frankly, I personally have no problem acknowledging that there are situations where women must defy their husband's wishes. The problem with this is that there is such a general atmosphere in our society that a husband basically doesn't have any special authority over his wife, that there's a kind of a co-equal partnership, and almost any time a woman disagrees with her husband, she can convince herself that there's compelling reasons and there's extenuating circumstances. Men can do the same thing, by the way, when they want to disobey authorities or whatever. It's a human trait that as soon as you acknowledge that some extenuating circumstances or moral circumstances may require resistance to authority, there is the danger, and this danger should not prevent us from acknowledging these exceptions, but we need to watch out for it, that once we acknowledge there are exceptions, we need to make sure that we don't, in self-interest, extend the range of those exceptions to whatever point we find comfortable. That is human nature to do, and Christians are capable of making that error also. I'm very happy to admit that women are free before God to disobey their husbands when their husbands are making choices that are morally corrupt for the family, or possibly even the man's just such a fool that he's bringing the family to destruction. There could easily be justification before God for a woman who's got her sense about her to go against her husband's wishes. But I'm cautious about that slippery slope. As soon as you admit that this is the case, which I'm not reluctant to admit, I just realize how much human nature would say almost every wife who wishes to rebel, as with any man who may wish to rebel against the rightful authorities, can make excuses and say, well, this is certainly one of those cases, when in fact it may not always be. We need to be morally honest before God in these matters and not just choose courses of convenience, and sometimes we're experts at rationalizing courses of action that aren't really right. Sam? Yeah, it's totally hard, and she definitely is unequally yoked here, you know. being unequally yoked is not in itself an excuse for women to just defy their husbands, because Peter says, of course, in 1 Peter 3, that women, even whose husbands do not obey the word, should win their husbands by their chaste conduct and obedience and submission and so forth, that a woman's rightly submitting to her husband, even if he's not a Christian, can be the means that God wishes to use to win him. But frankly, I certainly can find no fault with Abigail in this matter, and I think that there was a moral choice here to be made, not just one of convenience on her part, but a moral decision beside with David, and she did the right thing, in my opinion. Okay, verse 36. Then Abigail went to Nabal, and there he was holding a feast in his house, like a feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. Therefore she told him nothing, little or much, until morning light. So it was in the morning, when the wine had gone from Nabal, that his wife had told him these things, and that his heart died within him, and he became like a stone. He apparently got paralyzed, had a stroke or something. And then it happened after about 10 days that the Lord struck Nabal and he died. Sounds like he struck him earlier than that, but apparently he had an initial stroke that paralyzed him, and then 10 days later another stroke and all like it killed him, and the Lord sent upon him. So when David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be the Lord who has pleaded the cause of my reproach from the hand of Nabal, and has kept his servant from evil. For the Lord has returned the wickedness of Nabal on his own head." And David sent and proposed to Abigail to take her as his wife. And they only recently met, but that didn't matter a great deal in those days. Now, David already had a wife, you may recall. Or did he? We read down verse 44 that Saul had given Michal, his daughter David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was from Gath. Now, what this means is that the king, by simply executive order, decreed the divorce of Michal from David and gave her to someone else. So now she was legally another man's wife. We'll find later on, when Saul is dead and David is king, in 2 Samuel 3, verses 14 through 16, that David will retrieve Michal. He considers a legal divorce and her legal remarriage not valid. He had given her no grounds for divorce, and she probably had never chosen to divorce him, although she may have gotten tired of being like a widow out there with him running maybe open-ended away from home and so forth. But we do know that her second marriage was one where at least her husband cared a lot for her, because when David called for her to come back, her husband followed weeping But he was forced to turn back and leave her to David, because she was David's wife. I mean, David had done nothing to deserve the loss. And it raises important issues about divorce and remarriage. Certainly, if David was right to take Michal back, and it's hard to imagine how he would have been wrong to do so, since he'd never divorced her and she had no right to remarry in the first place. And as Jesus said, a case like that, it's just the second marriage is just adultery. It's not a marriage. It's an adulterous relation sanctioned by the state. Well, how many modern marriages, even in the church, may be in that state, you know? Adultery from the beginning. Of course, as I understand it, even marriages that are disapproved by God at their outset, for instance, if they're entered into sinfully, when the parties repent and turn to God, there are times when there's no restitution that can possibly be made to the former spouse. Perhaps the former spouse is remarried or dead or simply totally unwilling to have back their spouse. And I believe that the second marriage, though it was entered into sinfully, can become sanctified by God if the parties repent and if there's no way that they can make right what they did wrong. I don't think that a divorce of the second marriage is necessarily called for. How do I know that? Well, I don't know for sure, but I base it very largely on David's marriage to Bathsheba later on, because David committed adultery with her, and while it is true she was, strictly speaking, a widow when he married, he had her husband killed, therefore he'd made a widow of her, and the Bible makes it very plain when he married her, it says the Lord was displeased with David for marrying her. So he entered sinfully into a relationship with Bathsheba, which God called adultery. But when David repented, the prophet Nathan announced to him what the consequences of his misdeed would be, but he did not require David to divorce Bathsheba. Once David repented, it was not necessary to, you know, send Bathsheba off to be a widow now forever, but the marriage was allowed to continue, and it was even blessed because the fruit of that marriage became the next king and the descendant of, or the ancestor of Christ. Now, that is not an indisputable sanction on the marriage, but it is nonetheless an indication that God did not fault David for continuing in the marriage after his repentance, even though it was wrong for him to enter into it. And based on that principle, my suggestion is that there are, of course, many people who are today in marriages that should be properly called adultery. But if they have repented and turned to Christ, and if there is no possibility of restitution being made for the wrong done earlier, that I'm of the opinion that those marriages can continue sanctified by the Lord. There are, of course, many who would take a different opinion. There's a wide variety of opinions on that. But Michal was wrongly taken from David and given to another man. David did not approve of this. He was victimized by the situation. The man who married the second time was way out of line, was living in adultery with her. He may have been emotionally attached to her, but that didn't change the fact that it was adultery, and he had to lose her, and David got her back. Now, what about David? Was he committed adultery? He married Abigail now. Now, it's not so much that she was unavailable for marriage. Her husband was now dead. David didn't even flirt with her before that, as far as we know. But after her husband was dead, he proposed marriage. And, you know, she was available, but was he? If someone says, well, yeah, he was divorced now, well, that doesn't really change anything, because he didn't approve of the divorce. He didn't acknowledge the divorce. When he came to power and was able to enforce his will, he took Michal back. He did not consider that divorce valid. Therefore, of course, he was taking a second wife at the same time. And later on, he took more still. In fact, we read of another one a little later here. And altogether, we have record of about 8 different wives that David had simultaneously. Therefore, we have, of course, David bordering on disobedience to a command found in the 17th chapter of Deuteronomy that the kings of Israel should not multiply wives for themselves. Of course, David might say, well, hey, only 8, that's not very many. Some kings have 100. David's son had 1,000. So maybe he thought, 8, that's not multiplying, that's just adding. You know, you get up to around 700 wives and 300 concubines, that's multiplying. It's I suppose there could have been considered a matter of opinion about that, but the point is that David did not obviously consider it wrong to take additional wives. Polygamy, not having ever been strictly forbidden in the law, and having been tolerated in some cases like that of Jacob and Abraham and so forth, It probably never occurred to David that it was wrong to take additional wives. And we don't read of God holding it against him, because in those days, God was, I think because of the hardness of heart, he was putting up with a fair number of subnormal marriage practices, including divorce, as Jesus later said, that because of the hardness of their heart, he allowed polygamy also. Neither divorce nor polygamy, however, were ever in God's original plan for marriage and should not be considered normative. Anyway, David sent and proposed to Abigail, take her, and when the servants of David had come to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her, saying, David sent us to you to ask you to become his wife. Then she arose and bowed her face to the earth and said, here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of my servant, the servants of my Lord. So Abigail arose in haste and rode on a donkey, attended by five of her maidens, and she followed the messengers of David and became his wife. Now, by marrying Abigail, realize that David, though in exile, came to control of a huge estate. Now, it's we don't know to what degree Abigail traveled with this band of outlaws. She must probably have done so, but who took care of their estate? We don't know. Perhaps trusted servants were left in charge of it. Perhaps she had adult sons that she could leave in charge of the estate. We don't know. But David, of course, became... he got a big grocery store there with his wife, and that probably made his men happy that he married her, because they wouldn't have to be scrounging around eating nuts and berries. They'd have 3,000 sheep and you know, a worthy feast for the troops. Though, of course, they couldn't just settle down there on the ranch. They had to keep moving, because if they settled anywhere, Saul would find them and kill them. But it was nice to know that they had access to this stuff. Now, I'm of the opinion Abigail probably did not stay at home on the farm while David traveled with his men, for a couple reasons. One, it would be dangerous for her. Saul would certainly learn that, I mean, because he had intelligence network throughout the whole country, he would have learned that she had married David and would easily capture her if she was easier to find than David was. If she was down on the farm, he'd capture her and then use her as a hostage to get David to surrender. So I'm of the opinion Abigail agreed to travel with David. To inconvenience herself, to leave a plush existence in a rich homestead and to live in the caves and wilderness and so forth, to be David's wife. In that respect, she was very much like Christians. Now, making the right kind of choice of discipleship, I want to point out before we leave this whole story of Abigail and Nabal that there may be an intentional type here. The Bible doesn't say so, but it's not inconceivable that Nabal here represents... But he's like Saul. Saul, who disdained David. And Abigail, perhaps like the nation of Israel, whom David later acquired. Saul was the father and husband of the nation until he died. And then David moved into that position. In moving into Nabal's place as the husband of Abigail, Abigail may be a type of Israel and Nabal a type of Saul. After all, Saul is a fool. And Nabal's a fool. His name means fool. Also, it is pointed out, verse 36, that the feast that Nabal was having was like the feast of a king. And that may just be a manner of speaking, but it's interesting because the king, the Saul, and Nabal was feasting and in that respect resembled the king. In any case, it is possible that this story is included, not because of any extreme significance to this marriage. Abigail, as it turned out, did give David his second son, Chileab, but it would appear he may have died young. He never figured significantly in the genealogy of David. That's mentioned in 2 Samuel 3:3. That is that Abigail bore a son to David. It was his second son, Chileab. 2 Samuel 3:3 mentions it. But since he was not a significant son, therefore there's nothing very significant about this marriage, except that it happened, and... It may have changed David's financial circumstances, but I don't know if that would have been sufficient reason to spend an entire long chapter telling the story. It seems like the writer wants us to see significance in it, and it may be that the whole story is a typological picture of David being scorned by Saul, but eventually that kingdom which Saul commanded became David's. Saul's wife, those under subjection to him, the nation came under David, and after Saul's death, which is recorded shortly after this. I point out to you that in verse 43 it says, David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, so both of them were his wives. So now he had three altogether. two legally, and one that was really still his wife in God's sight and in his. Ahinoam, we don't know very much about, but she was the mother of Amnon, and that was David's firstborn. So though Ahinoam is, we don't know very much about where he met her, how he found her. I mean, what's he doing out in the woods? Where did he find this woman? You know, Ahinoam. Maybe she was a servant girl in Abigail's home. Who knows? I mean, we know that Jacob married not only two women, but also as concubines. And it's possible that Ahinoam was one of the servant girls in the household of Nabal. It's hard otherwise to know where to run across a woman out there in the woods. But she actually became the mother of his firstborn son, Amnon, who unfortunately was like his father, willing to overstep sexual boundaries, and for this he died at the hands of Absalom. We read all this later on in the next book. But Ahinoam is from Jezreel, which is in the region of Judah. And it's possible that Abigail, as I said, represents the northern tribes of Israel, whom Saul commanded coming to David. And then Ahinoam, because she's from the region of Judah, represents the tribe of Judah coming later. It is seen in the opening chapters of 2 Samuel that the nation of Israel to the north accepted David's kingship later, actually. It turns out that the people of Judah did first for 7.5 years, and later the northern tribes did. And by taking these two wives, one of them from Israel and one of them from Judah, it may be intended as a type. I don't have any scriptural authority for saying so. This is just a thought that occurs to me. We read then in verse 44 of Michael having been taken from David and by Saul given to Palti. Chapter 26. Now the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is David not hiding in the hill of Hakilah, which is opposite Jeshimon?" Then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him, to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And remember, he had done that once before and had almost captured him. And David wrote a psalm at that time, a prayer for deliverance. He wrote Psalm 54. We read this at the end of chapter 23. And Saul came very close to capturing him, but the Philistines had attacked Israel, and Saul had to withdraw and go fight that battle. And the Ziphites apparently have come back. Saul said, "Listen, David's still around. You want to come after him?" And since that battle with the Philistines is over, and since Saul has already forgotten the oath he made and so forth in chapter 24, bring 3,000 men down and pursue David. King must not have had very much administrative duties that he could spend his whole life out on the field pursuing a man who wasn't even a threat. Verse 3, "And Saul encamped in a hill of Hakilah," the hill of Hakilah, "and which is opposite Jeshimon by the road. And David stayed in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. David, therefore, sent out spies and understood that Saul had indeed come. So David arose and came to the place where Saul had encamped, and David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Now Saul lay within the camp, and the people encamped all around him." This means, of course, at night they were asleep. "Then David answered and said to Ahimelech the Hittite, and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, brother of Joab, saying, 'Who will go down with me to Saul in the camp?' And Abishai said, 'I will go down with you.'" Now Joab, I think, I don't recall that we've encountered Joab prior to this, but he becomes extremely visible in the later narratives. Abishai was his brother and was later killed by Abner. But Ahimelech is a Hittite. That means he is a Canaanite. Just like later on, Bathsheba's husband is a Hittite. These Hittites were supposed to be exterminated in the days of Joshua, but they were not. These are the same people whom Abraham bought the cave of Machpelah to bury his dead in. And there's a lot of Hittites in the story of the Old Testament. But technically, they were Canaanites and were slated for extermination. They are among the people that that Joshua failed to wipe out. Some of them apparently became proselytes, or at least God-fearers, and were loyal to David at this time. Not only this Hittite, but also, of course, Bathsheba's husband, Uriah the Hittite, was one of David's mighty men. "So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and there Saul lay sleeping within the camp, with his spear stuck in the ground by his head. And Abner and the people lay all around him." Now Abner was Saul's general at this point. "Then Abishai said to David, 'God has delivered your enemy into your hand this day. Now therefore, please let me strike him at once with the spear right to the earth, and I will not have to strike him a second time.'" In other words, I can do it in one blow. "And David said to Abishai, 'Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord anointed and be guiltless?'
David said furthermore, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall strike him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall go out to battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But please, take now the spear and the jug of water that are by his head, and let's go. So David took the spear and the jug of water by Saul's head, and they got away. And no man saw it, or knew it, or awoke, for they all were asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. I would imagine this would have to be the only explanation, that a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. A king out on the battlefield in the region where his enemies are would hardly sleep, and everyone be asleep too. No sentries, you know. Here's the king, vulnerable. His general sleeps right next to him. They're both sound asleep. The enemy can walk right in and stand next to his sleeping bag and grab his, throw it through him if he wished to. And where are the sentries? I would imagine some sentry heads rolled that next morning, but a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. It was obviously supernatural. There's no way that an army would have left themselves this vulnerable otherwise. Then David went over to the other side and stood on top of the hill afar off, a great distance from between them. And David called out to the people of and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Do you not answer, Abner?" Then Abner answered and said, "Who are you, calling out to the king?" So David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy the Lord, your lord the king. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, you are worthy to die, because you have not guarded your master, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is, and the jug of water that was by his head." Now Abner must have been sweating bullets here, because he was right. He was worthy to die. Here he's charged with the protection of the king, and here's visible proof that someone has come close enough to kill the king, and Abner slept through it. I mean, that's a killing offense. That's a capital crime. However, Saul was not sane enough to stay on one page for more than a few hours at a time, I think. And I think Saul was taken by David's mercy on him this much, to the point that he tended not to focus on Abner's fault in this, but it certainly was something for which Abner would have been extremely culpable, and in most situations his head would have rolled. And then Saul knew David's voice and said, "Is that your voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king." And said, "Why does my lord thus pursue his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand? Now therefore, please, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it is the children of men, may they be cursed before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.'" Now, no one was literally saying to David, "Go serve other gods." What he's saying is, they've driven me out of Israel among the people of other gods so that I might be in the territory where the worship of the true God is not welcome. The only way I could live acceptably among the people that you've driven me to is for me to worship other gods. It's as if you're trying to force me to serve other gods than Jehovah. "Now therefore, do not let blood fall to the earth before the face of the Lord, for the king of Israel has come out to seek a flea, as when one hunts a partridge in the mountains." Now earlier, when David had spared Saul in the cave, David said, "What are you coming out against, a dead dog, a flea?" Someone asked me during the break what was meant by that. I think what he means is a dead dog. You know, what's the threat from a dead dog? A living dog might be a bit of a nuisance, but a dead dog is absolutely harmless. And a flea is relatively harmless too, a slight irritation maybe, but hardly a major enemy. And yet Saul was coming with 3,000 men. David's saying, this is so incongruous that you would come out with such a force against someone who's so harmless, someone who's so little threatened to you, so small, so insignificant as I am. And that's, of course, what he is saying when he refers to himself as a flea or like a partridge in the mountains. Then Saul said, "I've sinned. Return, son David." I bet David got tired of hearing him say that. "I've sinned." Saul says it a lot, but he never repents. "Return, my son David, for I will harm you no more, because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Indeed, I have played the fool," like Nabal, "and erred exceedingly." And David answered and said, "Here is the king's spear. Let one of the young men come over and get it. May the Lord repay every man for his righteousness and his faithfulness. For my Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I would not stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. And indeed, as your life was valued much this day in my eyes, so let my life be valued much in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation." Now, David doesn't say, as your life is valued by me, may my life be valued by you. he didn't have any confidence that Saul could be trusted to value his life more than a few moments. But he says, as God has seen that I valued your life, I trust that God may value my life and preserve it as I preserved yours. Then Saul said to David, may you be blessed, my son David. You shall both do great things and also still prevail. So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. And actually, there's no record of David ever seeing Saul again after this, or of Saul ever pursuing him again. Saul had problems of his own. Turns out that the Cold War between Israel and the Philistines began to escalate to a fighting war. Now, David, even though the real danger that he had suffered from Saul was probably past. I mean, Saul was soon to be engaged in the war that ended his life. Saul would not have the luxury of pursuing David anymore. And so David probably had no reason to be overly paranoid. But we find David, in chapter 27, more paranoid than before. He acts as if the danger has increased. He has to resort to extreme measures to secure his safety. Well, the supreme measure that he takes is that he deceives Achish, the Philistine leader, Philistine king of Gath, into believing that he is against Saul and that he wants to be on the side of the Philistines. Now, this, I believe, stems from wrong motivation, lack of faith. Because in chapter 27, verse 1, David said in his heart, now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. Well, how could he think that? When God had promised, not only by word, but by deed, had delivered him from Saul and had prophesied that he'd be king, how could David believe that he would perish in the hand of Saul? Well, it was a lack of faith in what God had said. And because of that lack of faith, he made a compromise. He lied. He went among the Philistines. And by doing so, endangered the greater purposes of God, because his ruse and his deceit of Achish on this occasion later led almost to him being forced to go out and fight wars against Israel, which David, of course, never would have agreed to do, but he had to pretend. And God softly spared him from having to go out and end up doing that. But David, I think, was quite wrong to go and do this. And we see that his reason for doing it was wrong. He didn't believe that God would spare him. He said, one of these days I'm going to die at the hand of Saul. It's very much like what Abraham did when he had promises from God that God would bless him in the land. But famine came and he thought he'd perish in the land instead of what God said, be blessed in the land. He didn't trust the word of God. So he went down to the Philistines, and he lied to them about the status of his wife, and also came close to endangering the purposes of God, because Sarah could have been violated. And she was to be the mother of the nation of Israel, and she could have been violated by a Philistine king because of Abraham's deception. Once again, God sovereignly moved to prevent disaster, but that doesn't mean Abraham was right to have done what he did. God just had come in and patch things up. And likewise, I think David's in a similar situation here. Both Abraham and David in these situations is acting out of fear, lack of faith. They become liars. They resort to a ruse. It almost gets them in big trouble. And if not for God's special intervention, they would have both suffered greater things, and God's purposes would have suffered greater things because of their lack of faith and the deception they made. So David said in his heart, now I shall perish someday by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines. Now, that's an interesting contrast to David's attitude at an earlier time, or maybe a later one, when he had a better attitude. If you look at Psalm 11, we do not know when Psalm 11 was written. As I say, it was either at an earlier time or very possibly at a later time when his faith was stronger. But in Psalm 11:1, he says, in the Lord I put my trust. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? And there were people counseling David, you better run away. And he said, no, not me. I'm going to put my trust in the Lord. Why should I run away? How do you say to me, run away, flee like a bird to the mountains? Now, that's exactly what David was in fact doing, fleeing and not putting his trust in the Lord here. So David has ups and downs in faith, and it's one of the marvels of Scripture. Among the books about ancient heroes, the Scripture almost always make their ancient heroes be almost superhumanly virtuous. Whereas the Bible, every one of its greatest heroes has feet of clay and makes mistakes and has its ups and downs. The Bible, in other words, unlike most, like legendary stories, the Bible describes real people. they're not one-dimensional people. They're not people who are uniformly good or uniformly bad. They're real complex people who have their good points and bad points, ups and downs, moments of great faith and moments of defective faith. It's rather encouraging, really, because that's what real people are like. Real Christians are like that, too. Now, he says, there's nothing better than that I should speedily escape to the land of the Philistines, and Saul will despair of me to seek me any more in any part of Israel. So I shall escape out of his hand. Then David arose and went over with 600 men who were with him to Achish, the son of Maach, king of Gath. So David dwelt with Achish at Gath, he and his men, each man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelite, and Abigail the Carmelitess, Nabal's widow. So they were clearly traveling with him. And it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, so he sought him no more. That was the end of the pursuit of David, however, at what cost. David said to Achish, if I have now found favor in your eyes, let me give a place in some town in the country, let them give me a place in some town in the country that I may dwell there, for why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you? Now, apparently David managed to convince Achish that he was the sworn enemy of Saul, as Achish also was, and Achish had shown him some favor. This may have been the same Achish or the son of the Achish who earlier David had feigned madness before and who had driven David out of his presence. If this was his son, it's a good possibility, depending on how much time had left, we don't know. Of course, this could only be a few months or years later, but if this was his son, it's much easier to understand why this Achish would not behave like the Achish in an earlier chapter. But anyway, David was convincing, and David basically spoke as if modest, you know, too modest to dwell in the royal palace with you. I mean, why should we be granted such an honored place in the royal city? Just give us some little village somewhere and we'll just to stay there. So Achish gave him Ziklag that day. Therefore, Ziklag has belongings of Judah to this day. Now, this statement alone tells us something about the time of writing of the books of Samuel. There's really not much else in Samuel to tell us when it was written, but this statement that Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah until this day points out that it was written after the kingdom divided, because neither Saul, David, or Solomon would ever have been called king of Judah. They were kings of Israel. All Israel, all 12 tribes were Israel. It was after the kingdom divided in the days of Rehoboam that you now had kings of Israel and kings of Judah. So the books of 1 and 2 Samuel were obviously written after the kingdom divided in the days of Rehoboam, because it makes reference to the kings of Judah, a term that would have never been used prior to the division of the empire. Verse 7, now in the time that David dwelt in the country of the Philistines, it was one full year and 4 months. Okay, so we've got over a year in that spot, though he's no longer running. It's the time he was running from Saul that we don't know whether it's measured in months or years, but here we know that he spent over a year in Ziklag, not running, but just waiting. And David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Girzites, and the Amalekites. For these nations were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as you go to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. Whenever David attacked the land, he left neither man nor woman alive, but took away sheep and oxen, donkeys and camels, and the apparel, and returned and came to Achish. When Achish would say, where have you made a raid today? And David would say, against the southern area of Judah, or against the southern area of the Jeremielites, or against the southern area of the Kenites. He was lying, but basically he was indicating that he was running raids on those who were also the enemies of the Philistines, so that Achish would approve. But David left none alive to tell the story. There was no one who escaped to inform upon him that he was actually striking people who were not enemies of the Philistines, but were enemies of Israel. Now, I say, boy, David's kind of a bloodthirsty guy, killing all the men and women and all that stuff. Why did he do that? How did he justify that? Well, the people that are described that he attacked, the Geshurites and the Girzites, in verse 8, both are mentioned in Joshua as being among the Canaanite people that the Jews were supposed to exterminate in the days of Joshua, but Joshua failed to do so. The Geshurites are mentioned in Joshua 13, verses 2 and 13. It's Joshua 13, verses 2 and 13. And the Girzites are mentioned in Joshua 16, verse 10. In both places, we learn that these people were supposed to be exterminated in an earlier generation. Joshua had not carried it out completely in his day. So David probably just saw himself as mopping up and finishing up what the Jews were supposed to have done centuries earlier, but which they had failed to do. Likewise, the Amalekites, in verse 8, we know about the Amalekites, know that they were supposed to be exterminated. Saul was supposed to have exterminated them and failed to do the job completely. So David was not really doing something illegitimate. He wasn't just being vengeful, or he wasn't just going out in boredom and vandalizing and attacking innocent people. He no doubt saw himself as finishing off the work that the armies of Israel were supposed to do at an earlier time and had not done. But these people he was killing were enemies of Israel. They were not enemies of Philistines. Therefore, he did not want the Philistines to know who it was he was attacking. There was no rapid mass communication in those days. But, of course, if any survivor from any of this he attacked would get away, they might report to Achish that David's men had come and done this. So he made sure that none escaped. We do not read whether he killed the children or not. We are just left to guess about that. It mentions men and women. And he did not kill all the animals, as he should have done. In this, he was made a mistake similar to what Saul had done when he attacked the Amalekites. Though we can say that David was not personally ever instructed by the Lord to go out and annihilate these people as Saul was. David was sort of doing, finishing up or continuing further the project of wiping out these people. We can't say that David was ever personally told by God that he had to go annihilate all these people. He was doing something that was decreed against them, but his keeping of their livestock might not have been a violation of any direct command God gave to him in these campaigns. Verse 11, David would save neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, saying, lest they should inform on us, saying, thus David did. And so was his behavior all the time he dwelt in the country of the Philistines for that year and 4 months. So Achish believed David, saying, he has made his people Israel utterly abhor him. Therefore he will be servant forever. This is not very noble of David to deceive the man like this. Chapter 28. Now it happened in those days that the Philistines gathered their armies together for war, to fight with Israel. And Achish said to David, you assuredly know that you will go with me to battle, you and your men. Now this probably scared David. Well, you know, I'm going to go fight against the Israelites? I mean, he had nothing against the Israelites. They were his people. He didn't want to fight them. But he had to keep up the charade, the pretense. And so David said to Achish, surely you know that your servant can do. A deliberately evasive kind of answer. He didn't say, okay, I'll kill Israelites if you want. But he just said, you know what I can do. As if to say, I'm right with you. And you know how much good I can do you. And Achish said to David, therefore I will make you one of my chief guardians forever. Now Samuel had died, and all Israel had lamented for him and buried him in Ramah in his own city. And Saul had put the mediums and the spiritists out of the land. That was good of him, because the Old Testament law in Deuteronomy required, and Leviticus required, that mediums and spiritists not be tolerated. Saul had been zealous about some things, and he had banished those who were practicing such things. Then the Philistines gathered together and came and encamped at Shunem. So Saul gathered all Israel together, and they encamped at Gilboa, which happened to be the mountain where Saul met his end a few chapters later. Then Saul saw the army of the Philistines. When he saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or Urim or by the prophets. Saul tried all the conventional ways, legitimate ways, of hearing from God, but God just didn't want to speak to him, which raises serious questions about the assumption that you can just get a word from God whenever you pull the right strings and do the right things and jump through the hoops. And there are some people who give the impression that if you just tune the radio right, you'll get the message in. But that's apparently not true. God speaks when he wants to speak. You don't manipulate him to get a word from him. He initiates, and if he has no communication to give, you can use all the regular ways, talk to the prophets, the Urim and the Thummim, and whatever, and there'll be no answer. Then Saul said to his servants, find a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her. And his servants said to him, in fact, there is a woman who is a medium in Endor. Now, how'd they know? I mean, she's... right away they said, oh, we know a witch. So Saul disguised himself and put on other clothes, and because he couldn't go as Saul, because she wouldn't reveal her trade to him, since he had banned that kind of behavior. So he had to disguise himself. But when you stand head and shoulders taller than everybody else, it's hard to know, David, how would you conceal that fact? You tall guys, a short guy might, you know, wear elevator shoes, but a tall guy, what's he going to do, on his knees or something? Anyway, he concealed his identity to some extent. And he went, and two men with him, and they came to the woman by night, and he said, please conduct a seance for me, and bring up for me the one that I shall name to you. And the woman said to him, look, you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off the mediums and the spirits from the land. Why do you lay a snare on my life to cause me to die? And Saul swore to her by the Lord, saying, as the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. Now, her statement may have come from the fact that she knew it was Saul. I mean, he was tall. How could a king who is, you know, who is well known throughout the country and taller than everybody, how could he successfully conceal himself from somebody at close range as to his identity? Even if he was covering his face, that would look suspicious. She no doubt suspected it was Saul. But she said, she pointed out to him later, but she basically exacts from him an oath that she will not be punished for this. Then the woman said, whom shall I bring up for you? And he said, bring up Samuel for me. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice, and the woman spoke to Saul, saying, why have you deceived me? For you are Saul. And the king said to her, do not be afraid. What did you see? And the woman said to Saul, I saw a spirit ascending out of the earth. So he said to her, what is his form? And she said, an old man is coming up, and he's covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived that it was Samuel, and he stooped with his face to the ground and bowed down. Now Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? And Saul answered, I am deeply distressed, for the Philistines make war against me, and God has departed from me and does not answer me anymore, neither by prophets nor by dreams. Therefore I have called you that you may reveal to me what I should do. Then Samuel said, why then do you ask me, seeing the Lord has departed from you and has become your enemy? And the Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor, namely David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord, nor execute his fierce wrath upon Amalek, therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Therefore the Lord will also deliver Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. The Lord will also deliver the army of Israel into the hand of the Philistines. When Samuel said, you'll be with me tomorrow, one wonders, well, did Saul go to heaven? But in all likelihood, you and your sons will be with me suggests that you'll be in the place of the dead. I believe that prior to the death and resurrection of Christ, those who died, whether righteous or not, went to one place. I believe the place was compartmentalized, though. I believe there's a place where, within that one place, where those who died in faith went and those who died without faith also went to another place, but they were within view of each other. They were in the general same area. We know this because Jesus told a story in Luke 16 about a rich man and a beggar who both died. One was saved and one was not, and yet they were able to converse back and forth. They were close enough, but one was in flames and the other was not. So there must have been two compartments of this place of the dead, and Samuel and Saul both were in this place the next day, but not necessarily in the same portion of the place. So one question arises, was this really Samuel? You know, the standard view of many evangelicals today is that it is impossible through mediums to conjure the dead. What you really get instead is a familiar spirit or a demon impersonating the person that you are hoping to reach. That a seance really not capable of bringing up the spirits of dead people. And this, by the way, this doctrine is not taught clearly in Scripture. The Bible does refer to familiar spirits, but never explains why they are so called. And it never says distinctly that you could not contact the spirit of a dead person, but it forbids you to try. I don't know whether those who go to seances and talk to people they think are their dead ancestors or whatever, I don't know if they are really talking to those people or to a demon impersonating them. It could be, but it doesn't matter. It's forbidden. It's wrong in any case. The fact that it might work doesn't make it okay. In this case, it apparently worked. There are some who are so devoted to this view that you cannot contact the dead that they say, well, this was not Samuel. It's rather a familiar spirit impersonating Samuel. However, they seem to be wise beyond what is written, or claimed to be, because this says it was Samuel. It says Samuel appeared, and Samuel said this, and Samuel said that, and what was prophesied by the apparition was true. It was a true prophecy. And it really happened. Every word of it true. I have reason to believe this was the spirit of Samuel. And for that reason, we might conclude that sometimes in seances people really do contact the dead. Although we could also argue that this was an exceptional case, that it, virtually in all other cases when people go to seances, they really encounter a deceiving spirit, not the spirit that they think they're contacting, but that God in this case made an exception and sent Samuel to rebuke Saul. all of these explanations are possible. We cannot settle it now, and though we may be curious, it's not one of the most important things for us to work through. Verse 20, then immediately Saul fell full length on the ground and was dreadfully afraid because of the words of Samuel. And there was no strength in him, for he had eaten no food all day or all night. And the woman came to Saul and saw that he was severely troubled and said to him, look, your maidservant has obeyed your voice, and I have put my life in my hands and heeded the words which you spoke to me. Now, therefore, please heed also the voice of your maidservant, and let me set a piece of bread before you and eat, that you may have strength when you go out on your way. But he refused and said, I will not eat. But his servants, together with the woman, urged him, so he heeded their voice. He's easily persuaded one way or the other in many cases. He's quite spineless. He said, I won't eat. Then they talked to him and persuaded, okay, I will. So he arose from the ground and sat on the bed. Now the woman had a fatted calf in the house, and she hastened to kill it. And she took flour and baked unleavened bread from it. So she brought it before Saul and his servants, and they ate it. Then they arose and went away that night. In chapter 29, then the Philistines gathered together all their armies at Aphek, by the fountain which is in Jezreel. At some time around this time, David was joined by some warriors from the tribe of Manasseh, according to 1 Chronicles 12, 19 through 22. We won't turn there because of the shortage of time, but it's 1 Chronicles 12, verses 19 through 22, tells us that while David was here, some mighty men of the tribe of Manasseh joined him, so his loyal followers were increasing in numbers. Verse 2, and the lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands, but David and his men passed in review at the rear with Achish. So Achish and the other Philistine kings were watching as the troops went by, and David's armies came along at the end of the line. And the princes of the Philistines said, what are these Hebrews doing here? And Achish said to the princes of the Philistines, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me these days or these years? And to this day I have found no fault in him since he defected to me. Achish is sort of boasting in David as sort of a trophy. David was the hero of the Israelites, and now he's been my servant for these years. And it's kind of a boast of his that he's got this trophy. But the princes of the Philistines were angry with him. So the princes of the Philistines said to him, make this fellow return, that he may not go back, that he may go back to the place which you have appointed for him. And do not let him go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become our adversary. For with what could he reconcile himself to his master, if not with the heads of these men? Is this not David, of whom they sang to one another in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands? Well, that particular song really grated on those Philistines. They keep bringing it up. And Achish called David and said to him, surely as the Lord lives, you have been upright, and you're going out and you're coming in with me in the army is good in my sight. For to this day I have not found evil in you since the day of your coming to me. Nevertheless, the Lord do not favor you. Therefore, return now and go in peace, that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines. Then David decided to really play this up, though he must have been greatly relieved. David said to Achish, but what have I done? And to this day, what have you found in your servant as long as I have been with you, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king? But Achish answered and said to David, I know that you are as good in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the princes of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us to the battle. Now therefore rise early in the morning with your master's servants who have come with you, and as soon as you are up early in the morning and have light, depart. So David and his men rose early to depart in the morning and to return to the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went to Jezreel. Now, there's another problem that David's lies engaged him in, or got him involved in. Not only did he almost have to fight his own people, but by even showing up for this parade of soldiers, he had to leave his wives and children and his soldiers' wives and children behind at Ziklag. And while gone from there, that is, while the men were gone, a band of Amalekites came and kidnapped the wives and children. So David really put his family at risk by this whole deception. In chapter 30 it says, now it happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag and attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire and had taken captive the women and those who were there from small to great. They did not kill anyone but carried them away and went their way. They didn't have to kill anyone. There were no men there to fight, so they just captured all the women and children. So David and his men came to the city, and there it was, burned with fire, and their wives and their sons and their daughters had been taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. And David's two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, had been taken captive. It's hard to imagine these women would have been taken by these nomadic men without being violated. There's hardly any story of ancient wars where the raiders did not violate the women, although it seems like God may have supernaturally preserved that from happening here. Then David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters. I mean, their loyalty to David was one thing, but for him to make stupid decisions that led to the capture of their wives and children was something that really, it taxed their patience with David's questionable policies. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. That is, he encouraged himself by turning to the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, "Please bring the ephod here to me." And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. So David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them?" Now, isn't that interesting that he'd ask the Lord that? In almost any other situation, a man who's commanding armies, he wouldn't have to ask, "Shall I go and rescue my wife and children?" I mean, when you've been attacked, I mean, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, the United States military didn't inquire of the Lord to decide whether we should fight back. It was just assumed. You've been attacked. They've wronged you. You owe them something. And the idea of going saving the prisoners of war would be just taken as a given by conventional knowledge. But notice David assumed that even under this kind of provocation, he's not at liberty to go out and fight without the Lord. And that is one thing that's different about the battles in the Old Testament and those in modern times. The people who fought battles in the Old Testament could only do so with God's permission. And it wasn't always sure when God would approve. So you had to inquire of the Lord. That isn't happening today, and that makes the modern wars in an entirely unparalleled category. And God answered him and said, "Pursue, for you shall surely overtake them and without fail recover all." So David went, he and his 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Bezor, where those stayed who were left behind. Now they left some of the guys behind with the equipment, and a smaller number pursued. David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 stayed behind who were so weary that they could not cross the brook Bezor. And they found an Egyptian in the field who brought him to, and they brought him to David. And they gave him bread and he ate, and they let him drink water. And they gave him a piece of cake of figs and two clusters of grapes. So when he had eaten, his strength came back to him, for he had eaten no bread or drunk any water for 3 days and three nights. Then David said to him, "To whom do you belong and where are you from?" And he said, "I am a young man from Egypt, a servant of an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because 3 days ago I fell sick." But he apparently recovered as a result of fasting for 3 days. He'd had no food or water for 3 days out in the desert, and apparently he wasn't so sick anymore. He could lead David's men, as it turns out. So it shows something of the curative powers of fasting. "We made an invasion of the southern area of the Cherethites in the territory which belongs to Judah and of the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." And David said to him, "Can you take me down to this troop?" And he said, "Swear to me by God that you will neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this troop." So when he had brought him down, there they were spread out all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil which they had taken out of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. So David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, and David rescued his two wives, and nothing of theirs was lacking, either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them. David recovered all. Then David took all the flocks and herds which they had driven before those other livestock, and said, "This is David's spoil." Now David came to the 200 men who had been so weary that they could not follow David, whom they also had made to stay by the brook Bezor. So they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David, apparently some were that description, answered and said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give to them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart." David said, "My brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. For who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays with the supplies, and they shall share alike. And so it was from that day forward. He made a statute and an ordinance for Israel to this day. The ordinance was the people who stay home and the people who go to battle and fight the wars shall have equal share in the spoils. And that, no doubt, has a spiritual parallel. Many times people think that to really earn brownie points with God and get gold sticky stars in heaven, that you need to go out there on the front lines of the battle. Well, you do if you're called to, but some people aren't. Some people stay behind. Some people hold down the fort. And those people who stay behind and don't go out into battle, I believe will have the same reward if they're doing so in obedience to God as those who go out and, you know, do all the key things. David recognized this and became a policy and ordinance in Israel. Verse 26, now when David came to Ziklag, he sent some of the spoil to the elders of Judah, to his friends, saying, here's a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord, trying to make some friends of the Judah people. Some of them had, of course, helped him in the past. To those who were in Bethel, those who were in Ramoth in the south, and those who were in Jatir, and those who were in Aror, and those who were in Sifmoth, and those of Eshtimoah, those who were in Rachal, those who were in the cities of the Jerahmeelites, those who were in the cities of the Kenites, those are the ones that he claimed to be killing when he told Achish what he was doing, but these were actually his friends, and those who were in Hormah, those who were in Korsashan, those who were in Aphek, those who were in Hebron, and to all the places where David himself and his men were accustomed to roam. That is, these people had tolerated David's presence and even probably helped support him, and so now that he had some spoils, he gave gifts to these people to show his gratitude. Chapter 31. You didn't think so, but here we are. So the Philistines fought against Israel. And the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Then the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. Ishbosheth, however, was a son they didn't kill. We haven't read of him yet, but we will later. Now the battle became intense against Saul, and the archers hit him. He was hit with arrows, and he was severely wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor-bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell on it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul and his three sons, his armor-bearer and all his men, died together that same day. And when the men of Israel, who were on the other side of the valley, and those who were on the other side of the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook the cities and fled, and the Philistines came and dwelt in them. Now, Saul's death is recorded here one way. It's recorded another way in the next chapter. That is 2 Samuel chapter 1. We'll wait till we get there to talk about that difference. So it came to pass in the next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent word. They treated him the way David had treated Goliath, in other words. And they sent word throughout the land of the Philistines to proclaim it in the temple of their idols among the people. Then they put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths, which is their goddesses, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth Shan for display, for basically to dishonor his body, just put up a headless body to display it as a trophy. And when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and traveled all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Beth Shan. And they came to Jabesh and burned them there, since burial was probably impossible, since they were probably a bit putrefied by this time. Then they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted for 7 days. Now, these men of Jabesh-Gilead were the ones that Saul had delivered when they had been attacked by the Ammonites. You remember that they were the ones who were in risk of losing their right eyes if they couldn't get help. And Saul's very first military campaign had been to take the armies of Israel to rescue these people. And they felt indebted to Saul. And so when they heard of the indignity done to Saul's body, they came and wanted to give him a decent burial. So they burned his body, took the charred bones, and gave him a decent burial. By the way, David commended them for this later on, as we'll be in 2 Samuel. He was glad that somebody had shown some respect to Saul. And that is how this book ends, but it's not really over. 2 Samuel is simply a continuation, originally the 2-1 book. So in our next session, we'll go into 2 Samuel and continue the story.